From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show, and excited about today. Of course, we are on a mission to ignite an entrepreneurial revolution right here in the hometown we love. But we do that by building a backyard advantage, which really is becoming the most connected community in the world for local entrepreneurs. It's based around this culture of love, helping one another. And today on the show, we have Jay Ezell and Alec Fisher. They are Natoma Wealth, and they are a huge part of the backyard advantage and the connective tissue that makes this, this love circulate throughout our community and beyond. But thank you guys for coming on the show. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about, that question, what if you actually do well? And then, what does that mean for your family? How should you plan for that? How should you, it's kind of a continual execution of that plan too. So we'll talk a little bit about that. But we also stick around at the end of the show. I always like to talk to Jay. He's been on the show a number of times, but I'd like to talk to you about the economy, because we can kind of step back from my portfolio or, what I'm doing with my family and my kids, and my grandkids. But we can talk about, what do we expect to happen in 2027? What do we expect to happen maybe over the next 5 or 10 years? What does the Trump administration do to cause a ripple throughout the economy in terms of emotion? So we'll talk about all of that. But really, I think we're going to talk a little bit today about legacy. And so you brought on your brother-in-law, Jay, and business partner, Alec Fisher. You guys married sisters, and I've known your sisters a long time, or the sisters, I should say.
Yeah.
And you married into that wild family.
Yes, it's a lot. It's great.
Oh, yeah. Yep, absolutely. Happy to be here, Mark.
Thank you for being here. So which family has got the wildest dynamic between the two? Because that's kind of an interesting thing. I know Hannah always seemed to be, that's Alec's wife, always seemed to be a little wild child. And Amy was a little more, always super positive, but, they're less out there, I would say.
Yeah. No, it's a lot of fun. I mean, obviously, it's with 5 kids and 4 kids, my kids being a little older than Alex for the most part. We're going through different phases in life, but I think I would say confidently that both of our houses have a fun dynamic and lots of energy.
It's all chaos. And they all love each other. They see each other all the time. Yeah. So it's great.
When you married sisters, but they're both in education, and then their mother was in education.
Yeah, so still is.
So you've got this dynamic where you guys are entrepreneurial. You're out growing businesses, your business as well. So it's kind of like they've got sort of like more of a regimented type of occupation.
Yeah. Yes.
Where you guys, I know I've been out with you late at night, and which is like 9 o'clock for me. But but so you're just showing up for your clients and for the people that need you. So so maybe with that said, let's think about who our audience is here. I think there'll be people in our audience that let's say are my age. I'm 62. Grandfather of 7 now, and their ages 1.5 to 15. Mm-hmm. So you've got that dynamic of I've got the third generation.
Right.
Your kids are college, most late high school and college.
Yeah.
And Allie, how old are your kids?
My kids are first to eighth grade. So
first to eighth grade. So you're kind of that next generation or half generation down. So when we speak to these, different people, we'll be speaking to people who maybe are thinking about retiring, people who are about to make it big potentially.
Right.
And so it's sort of how it all fits. But so maybe with that said, you suggested we talk about legacy. And so what does that mean to you when you think about people's legacy?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we talk a lot, your show talks a lot about succession, right? What do you do as you're working your entire life, something you're passionate about, you're scaling, growing, sacrificing time, doing all the things that people do to scale and grow a business. We kind of view legacy as the next iteration or even a subset of succession. And what I mean by that is we all work hard. Some people become very successful in life and they build, some level of wealth, right? The first question we typically hear from people is, well, now that I have this, how do I make sure that the generation down or the generation down below them doesn't just blow all this money, right? And so it's this idea of value systems. Who are we as a family? What do we believe in? Making sure that generationally that those ideas, those concepts are passed down, not just talked about, but reinforced and instilled in the family system.
All right, well, Alec, I'm going to throw it over to you on in this case, because you've got the youngest set of kids.
Sure.
Is it, so they're up to eighth grade,
yep.
And you've got four kids, is that right?
Yep.
Are you talking to them? I'm obviously you're talking about the family values, but what kinds of things, I guess, go into those family values to help shape the outcomes so that they're still driven when they get to college? They're still driven when, you know, dad hits one out of the park.
Sure. So some of the things that I like to talk about with my kids, and it's on a smaller scale, but you always want to introduce finances to your kids as soon as possible. I don't think there's any time is too soon. I've started my kids off with a simple save, share, spend process to at least get them introduced to the money. So so if they were to say earn say $20, how much of that are you going to save? How much are you going to spend? And how much are you going to share? So philanthropy brings in philanthropy. It brings in the saving portion of it, and it brings in, hey, what do you want to buy today? So it really kind of brings in, you know, all aspects of our life on a smaller scale and introduces that topic to them, because as they get older, that becomes much more important, and you want them to be able to learn that at the earliest age as they possibly can.
Yeah, frankly. It's interesting to think about the save. Let's start with the save piece, right? So save. Do they have to earn the money, or do they just get given money? Like, how does that? Because they all get Christmas gifts. You know, you get your $25, or I don't know how much you give them. You know, maybe grandparents throw in money. You know, maybe your mother-in-law. But they end up accumulating almost like we've spoiled our grandkids, I think, at some level with gifts. But like, what's the best way to like develop the idea that, you know, it's not all going to be given to
you? Well, that's a great question, and I think everybody might approach this in a different way, and I don't think there's any wrong or right way to do it. The way that I think about it is that you're a part of our household, and you're there to help, right? Mm. So whether it's doing the dishes, whether it's locking up the chickens or opening the chickens, whatever the household task is, or if I ask you to do it, you need to do it, right? Mm. So, or you need to be helpful, and you need to help your siblings, and you need to be a part of that. And so from my perspective, just by being a part of that, I'm okay with giving you, say, a monthly allowance for that. And it goes
for being a contributor to the household.
So it's not necessarily, hey, you get $5 for doing the dishes, you get $5 for opening up the chicken and coop, or whatever it might be, whatever makes our life easier. It's basically being a part of our household and part of the system, and really not pushing back on any of that stuff. And so from that perspective, it's almost like an allowance. Mm-hmm. But again, you have to be a contributing member of our household to be able to participate.
And you've got four different kids with four different personalities. Your wife, Hannah, was really driven, high-level gymnast, college diver.
Yep.
She and my daughter were really close and roommates in college and stuff. So I've seen the drive. You know, you can be a fun-loving person and still be really freaking driven.
Yep, absolutely.
Do your kids share that? And you're driven. Do your kids share that drive, or are some showing signs of, you know, not having it?
Another great question. And I think they absolutely are. And I've actually made this comment to somebody recently, and I'm proud to say that the older kids in middle school, sixth and eighth graders, are straight A students, and I don't have to do anything. That's just their drive gets them to those grades. Mm-hmm. And so whatever it was, I'll give my wife the credit that she's instilled in them, has given them that drive. So, you know, I'll hear from my daughter, who's eighth grader, Amelia. I'll hear it if she got a B+ on a test or an A-. She wants that solid A. She doesn't get an A+. She wants to know why. So absolutely, they're driven.
So it's save, and then it's spend, and it's share. Is spend part of it?
Yeah,
spend?
Absolutely.
Okay, so how to spend.
So spend would be, okay, what do you want to use your money for today? And typically right now, I'll use my daughter again as an example. She's got, you know, her phone and Apple Pay and things like that. Mm-hmm. Typically, it's when she's out with friends or something like that. She's got some money available for her to buy, whatever an eighth grader buys for boba drinks or, you know, all that foo-foo stuff that they love. But
well, it's interesting to think about the save piece because saving is not necessarily fun, right? It's not, especially they're probably not saving cash in a coffee can where they actually see it. It's digital to them. So are they involved in knowing how much they're saving and then how much
Absolutely.
They can spend?
Yep. And I share that with them, and I have their some of their save invested, and I'll absolutely share that with them. I think that's part of the educational process, is showing them what that looks like, what long-term investing looks like, things like that. But it going back to that comment, I talk about this a lot. Remember back in the day to when you got cereal and you got all like the points and you had to mail it off to Michigan and you forgot about it. And then 8 months later you get something. So you had to work to get that. You had to mail it off and then you had to wait and show patience. Right. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I feel like investing is a little bit like that. You're putting this money that you could potentially use today. You're putting it away for the future. Right. And okay. so I use that kind of as an example.
Yeah.
Sometimes especially for kids.
Yeah, it's nice when you have like a raise. It might show up in one person as a tax return or something.
Yeah.
I paid the taxes. I got some back. You're happy. It's like you found money, right?
Yeah. Right.
For the rainy day fund. Okay. So then share. That's an interesting. I like those three, and I don't know that a lot of people think about that component. So I have to imagine once you're more wealthy. That comes into mind more, but when you're still trying to, build for, buying your first house or building for buying your first car or whatever, that the share piece is like, that's real world.
Absolutely.
I don't want to call it pain, but that's unselfishness, I guess. Mm-hmm. Is that hard to teach? I never really spent a lot of time teaching.
Yeah,
my kids.
Not necessarily. Yeah. And again, that's going to come down to, it depends on the family, right? Mm-hmm. And what their core values are, right? And what sometimes it's faith, so sometimes it's easy, right? Mm-hmm. It could be, we have it more fortunate than a lot of. This is a great time of year, Christmas time, to think about, hey, reflect, like, we have a lot of things, you get a lot of things, and there's some kids out there that aren't getting a lot of things, and this is the time for you to potentially take a little portion of that and share it.
I think this time of year too, Jay, and I don't know what your sense on this is, like, so we've got two little grand, we have seven grandkids, but we're trying to we'll try to like lead by example versus like when you're the grandparent, you can't mandate.
Right.
You can help facilitate. So you could help facilitate adopting a family or something like that. And so we are trying to, I guess, call it lead by example or get them involved so that it's easy, but they haven't had to pull it out of their own bank account. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of an interesting thing. Yeah, I'd love to have your perspective.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think going back to Alex's point around teaching share. So both of our families, the K-8 school they go to, which is public school, has used to be required as more maybe voluntary contributions that families make. Mm-hmm. And all of our kids play sports, different sports, athletic programs. Most of those have some family funding component, whether it's at the school or through their sports programs. So like in our family, we talk about the fact that, hey, if you guys are going to go on this trip to Yosemite in sixth grade, which is awesome, by the way, that's funded by families making contributions. So it teaches at an early age, we get to do really cool things because people in our community support
us. Everybody pitches in.
So then they learn at a very early age, hey, we're going to make sure that as we grow, as we have an opportunity, if I can't give monetarily, I'm going to give time. So whether it's through student government or things like that. So they learn what it means to be part of a community, how to lift that community and make it more valuable to everybody. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. So that's cool. So in terms of... that was a kind of a basic concept that you're dealing with kids, but you two, for the most part, besides within your own family, I imagine, how often your clients are high net worth type people for the most part, people who are in the process of making it or have made a certain amount of wealth. What kinds of things go in besides, maybe the early child development in terms of creating those values, but then as they get a little bit older, like your kids are a little bit older, Jay, and I have, adults that are roughly Alex's age, so they're, late 30s. So, this is a little bit different when they're, 35, 37, 39 than it is when they're, let's say, college age.
Sure.
So how do you, in helping your clients, you're talking to people though that are maybe like my age that are starting to, you know, build wealth.
Yeah.
And they're having to make sure that they are helping build the family correctly.
Yeah. That's a great question. I think a lot of it comes down to what is each individual family trying to accomplish in this conversation. Everyone has a different starting point, whether that's on the balance sheet or the family dynamic. And so part of our job is, as we're talking through the idea of legacy, value system, stewardship, is where are you today? What discussions have you had in the past? Where are there gaps? And then what are we trying to accomplish? So we might find a family that has a couple of early 20-year-old kids that have had some interaction with the family, family business, whatever it might be. So it's an easier dialogue to tie that family value system together, as opposed to somebody to say generation three and 50 years old, but was never part of generation one creating that wealth. So the education process is different. Then we go back to fundamentals, making sure they understand, how do you earn a dollar? That seems funny to tell a 50-year-old, but how do you earn the dollar? How was it created? What the effort that was taken to get there? And then what systems need to be in place to make sure that they're in line with what that family wants to attain.
So I have to imagine there are plenty of people where, let's say dad goes out and he works his long hours and we don't see him much, but we know he owns his own business and you know, he's always into it. And, you know, he's, you know, we've seen the example of the way he lives his life. He's a good guy. But he didn't come home and dump the business on us.
Yeah.
You know, dump the business meaning share what happened throughout the day.
Right.
He pretty much went and made the money. Mom took care of the household. Potentially could be, the roles could be reversed, but those communications just never happen. So you grow up and you get a job as a teacher or working, you know, as an employee, and you really don't get exposed to some of the things that really built the wealth initially.
Right.
So I have to imagine those are the kinds of things you're talking about, is like you're still in the wealth build. If you inherit money, you're still in the wealth building mindset at some level.
Absolutely. And that's part of it, is understanding, especially if you have an environment to where somebody was successful as generation one, as an entrepreneur, you know, running their own, starting, scaling, and evolving their own business, as opposed to generation two, working a job for somebody else, like helping them understand the stress that goes along, the weight that you have to carry. And as wealth is created, the goal is to make it generational, to where it's not just to help you generation two or generation three, but it continues to evolve for generations down the line, as well as making sure it's supporting organizations, individuals that the family cares about. So going back to that share component, that's a big, big part of our discussions with people. And there's really effective strategies from tax, estate, that integrate well and teach stewardship along the way too.
Yeah. So one of the things that, with my family, you know as well, I'm sharing this maybe for the audience, but they are, you know, they're driven, they're entrepreneurial, and they're still on the, you know, on the way up. They haven't made it yet though, but they still have a lot of drive. So I think sports early on, and absolutely, nothing's handed to you, you know, right, no participation trophies. I know you guys into sports a lot, so I can see just you can learn a lot of the things that give you basic drive in life in ways other than having your own business, like on the athletic field or in school and things like that. To me, those are really, falling back on some of those principles can really help. And I'm thinking of this one family. I'm not going to mention any names, but they got thrust in. The dad built a very significant set of businesses, and then the kids really weren't involved in the business.
Right.
And yet, he passes away. He's got to quit working and quit being the CEO. And all of a sudden, this guy who's been a basketball coach and kind of more like just a really good guy is thrust in because he's the male son that had, I guess, the most business acumen. He's now got to run this empire. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And those are the type of clients that you guys run into occasionally. Right. And so are you helping bring that person, might need a CEO to come in that if there hasn't been a good progression.
Yeah, completely. And that's, it goes back to your point about community. It's like, who in the community do you know that can assist either from a coaching standpoint, mentorship standpoint, or as a replacement if there's just not the right fit? But it still goes back to the fundamentals of, you are now, unfortunately, in that situation, thrust into a situation where I have to be responsible for lots of things that I was never ready for, potentially, and helping them make the right decisions, aligning a team around them that can support professionally, personally, around all the things that matter that this person's father would have had to deal with, and making that transition as quickly as possible so mistakes aren't made that are, you know, catastrophic to the family.
I would have to imagine it's more risky to try to pass along a family business and put a person that really hasn't built the business all of a sudden in charge at age 50, who's been more of an employee. Now he's thrust into this real leadership position versus if you don't have a family business and it's just sort of a set of investments that have a lot of value and you want to preserve and grow.
Yeah.
I can imagine there being a pretty big difference there.
Yeah, I completely agree. And there are times where you can have somebody that's been, you know, a key employee for the business and working under, you know, whether it's siblings or parents or whatever it might be, that may be prepared for that. That's probably not the most common case. So yeah, I would think that, you know, more than likely, if you're inheriting or having to step in to manage a balance sheet that's material to your family, but not an operating company with employees and responsibilities like that, that's a totally different situation.
With an operating business, that's typically why you see key man insurance, right? You know, so you don't want to plan for something like that, you know, but for the other side of it, if it's just like the balance sheet of the family, that's why educating that next generation is so important as soon as possible, because if something like that happens, are they prepared to run that balance sheet, or are they prepared for that's where you fall into potentially a trap where you hear all the stories about the lottery winners that blow their money. Mm-hmm. Well, we have seen that with people that weren't ready for their inheritance because they didn't either know about it, or they weren't educated about it, or kept it completely hidden.
Yeah.
And depending on the situation, you can have, to your second comment about, you know, inheriting a balance sheet, depending upon the complexity of the balance sheet, right? You might have someone that maybe has an operating business or exited, but they have lots of investments on the balance sheet for the family that operate different ways, you know, not an operating business, but real estate investments that have particular components to them, or venture capital or private equity, that you have to at least understand the structure of those things and how they work and how that impacts your ability to take cash flow or have tax efficiency. And so that same person can still have a struggle being ready to manage that kind of balance sheet relative to, you know, a 401k balance or something like that.
So you and I, Jay, have talked about the, I think it's a Chinese proverb, the shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations, yeah, where the first generation goes out and earns something, some wealth. Second generation kind of uses that wealth. Mm-hmm. And the third generation doesn't have that wealth anymore. And so they kind of have to start over. Yet they've been probably living in a world where their parents were wealthy, and so they were even spoiled at some level.
Right.
So I know that has to be, we talked about the attitudes initially, but what other like things do you see happen with families that kind of screw them up for the, you know, for keeping the wealth and growing the wealth?
I think a lot of time it goes back to interpersonal, right? And so you can have situations to where, whether it was happening early on in childhood or as they got older and the parents were successful, there was either rivalry or there was a lack of trust. Some of that's driven by lack of understanding, maybe of inputs from either side, from siblings. But we've seen that unfortunately happen to where families, you know, generation one creates the wealth. They try and educate as best they can, and maybe there's some pushback from generation two or subsets of that. And because of lack of trust, one maybe is deemed as the executor or trustee. They have control. They start to pull some of that. And so you've got these environments to where instead of working as a family, even if you disagree on things, having that value system of here's what, whether it's mom and dad or, you know, whatever it is, generation one would have wanted, let's work toward it, even if we can't necessarily agree, working down that value system. That's something that I think is super important to try and eliminate or mitigate the risk of that shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations.
What percentage of the people of the people with the wealth don't care that much about passing it on to the next generation. There's this book, Die with Zero, yeah. right? So, and that's kind of an interesting read because it sort of takes the, if you feel a responsibility to pass something material along to your kids, it sort of makes you feel relief around, you know, not having that responsibility. So right. it's almost an easy read.
Yeah. yeah. Sure. I would say there's, I'll give my thought and then Alf, you want to chime in. I think you've seen that evolve a little bit. The idea used to be that generation one, we just keep using that example, but generation one is creating the wealth and there's some feeling like I have to leave something. And so you see books like this, so I'm going to die with zero or my last check is going to bounce, you know, whatever, yeah. whatever the term is. But I think what we're seeing is, yeah, that's probably fine. But along the way, I'm still going to be supporting and giving opportunities to my kids, grandkids, sooner so they can use and benefit mm-hmm. from it more today than 30 or 40 or 50 years.
Yeah. And I think now. That's one of the things that that book suggested is if yeah. there was ever a time to unload some of your wealth productively through your kids, it's probably while they're in their prime, yes. They're in the middle of their launch, sure, right? Yes, right. Sure. It's when they have an opportunity, well, maybe loan them some money to buy their first house, mm-hmm. Invest into their first business or second business, something right. like that. Yeah. Right. So it's almost like support them when they need you the most, when they've got the little kids and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think that was more, that book to me represents more of a mindset shift. You know, it's not like, well, forget my kids kind of thing. It's more like, I'm not going to wait until I'm dead, my spouse or partner is gone, and then they get value. Because maybe the education, it wasn't there. Maybe there's something happens interpersonally with the kids from there. It's be present and help them along the way when they can most take advantage of it.
I have to imagine, too, one of the, I guess, things that can crop up is that let's use me and Stacy, for example, my wife. So getting us to agree on what we want is like, oh, you got to make some tough decisions yeah. here around, you know, what are you going to say no to in your life so you can save enough to make sure that, you know, you can live the rest of your life and pay the bills? Right. And then how much should be left to the kids or to charity or whatever? Like getting everybody to agree on that or maybe the principles of the original wealth to agree is one challenge, like a base challenge. Of course, getting the kids, the siblings, and their spouses to right. see eye to eye on what to do. How much do parents, like the wealth, the people that had created the wealth, then they're passing it along, how much challenge do you usually see them having in coming to a plan? And then also follow-up question, how much do they want to manage from the grave, right? So in other words, like, hey, I got this money, but I want to like pull every string even after I'm dead.
Yeah. I would say that every person's different. I find it pretty rare to find a couple that right off the bat agrees on any sort of plan when it comes to themselves. My wife, Amy, and I, if you talk about allocating money for investment, she'd dig a hole and stick it all in there. We're on the mm-hmm. complete opposite side, right? So we're in the same boat from that mm-hmm. perspective. But I think it's a discussion around what's important to the family. And they're always challenging discussions because there's some dynamic that you've got to overcome to get to that agreement. I think from the standpoint of, you know, from the grave, how much do I really still want to manage? That's, you mm-hmm. don't see that as much, but there are some clients that still
yeah,
think about that.
I'll jump in on that because it depends on the objective too, right? Because if it's trying to keep everything cohesive, then that's going to be a little bit more complicated. Mm-hmm. If it's a, hey, you're going to get 25% of this estate and you guys could go do your own thing, then that's different, right?
Yeah.
So it goes back to, you know, if it is a cohesive strategy that we're trying to do, then it's going to be family meetings, right? Yeah. And you're going to have to get, you know, again, going back to the value system, what's the mission statement of the family and how does everybody live by that? And how does everybody, you know, how are we going to use our family wealth to help us get from here to there, right? Mm-hmm.
So you suggested that we, my kids present a family mission statement to my wife and I. Is that the typical format? Is like I have adult children, right? 37 and 39. And you said, hey, why don't you ask them or I can have them write, propose a family mission statement. We haven't got around to doing it yet, but it's not something I don't believe in, so I'm waiting for the right time.
Yeah.
But like, how is that sort of a common approach, and at what age do, you know, at 17, that might not be the time to do, have them do the family mission statement, right? Because maybe you haven't really developed... Yeah. You're still trying to make the high school, you know, wrestling team or whatever.
Exactly, yeah.
In multi-generational planning, that's a very common thing to happen. It's a way to bring them in. And the mission statement is typically based off of the value system of that first generation, right? So the first step is understanding what, you know, the core issues are, and then you turn those issues into the values. So, you know, these are your issues. You know, you want to keep the family together. You want to keep this piece of property, whatever it might be. Okay. So then that means you value, you know, family, you value these things. And okay, how do we facilitate that? And that's when you bring them together, and then they create the mission statement based off of the value system for that first generation. And that's how that you instill that value system onto that next generation. So they see it. Mom and dad really believed in this or wanted this. Right. And it could be many different things, not just financial. It could be faith. It could be family. It could be monetary.
What do you do when people just don't disagree? Faith is an interesting one, because you might have one person who is a devout Christian and another person who's not sure, or maybe they're a non-believer potentially. And now you've got to, but mom and dad, of course, they're believers, right? But the couple of the four kids are, you know, not sure anymore because they went to the wrong college.
Sure. And that's where things can get pretty interesting. And sometimes you have to red light some things too, because there's even sometimes families with like a drug addict, right? It's like, how are you going to get them involved? How are they going to make any of these decisions? Right. And so sometimes tough decisions have to be made. And it really depends on, from my perspective, how important is that value to the family, right? And so if that is the number one most important thing,
okay,
and
they prioritize
line,
the values,
right. Yep.
Yeah. My and mom and dad are really central, or like in our case, it'd be, you know, the people that, you know, built something, and now they're trying to figure out how to, you know, make it shared a little bit. Okay.
Yeah. And that's the fun part, to watch that, you know, prompt from generation one that helps build generation two making the mission statement. And then generation one almost sits back a little bit as that discussion continues to thrive and grow the generation down. Like, you know, this is what we believe. Here's a mission state on how we're going to support the value system that you all have created. And then that interpersonal connection really starts to build. Doesn't always, right? There are times that you have red lights and you got to stop on some things. But seeing that interaction start to grow, one, it teaches stewardship, teaches responsibility, teaches connection as a community or as a family. So it's a really enjoyable part outside of, you know, markets and economy and all those things that we get to engage families about. And families are dynamic in lots of different ways. But it's something that's positive that leads usually down a very good outcome for most people that go through it.
Some people are very private about their financial affairs, sure, even with their kids, which is an interesting dynamic. And how do you break down that barrier? Because if you're going to be extremely private and not even share the information with your children, and I could see a couple of reasons why people might be like that, but you've got to break down that barrier.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard, because the biggest concern is the primary concern people get engaged in this is like, we don't want to erode their work ethic. Mm-hmm. We don't want them to think that they just can do nothing and they're going to inherit
all this money. We're worth $100 million, right, and they know they're going to get it.
Right. Why do anything else?
I'm going to drop out of school.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And so that's a really big part of it. So you have to go through that discovery with generation one. Is like, what are you willing to share? Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's to the decimal point, whether it's the idea, whether it's using a tool like a family foundation or other things that build visibility in some regard of to what the family value, like, you know, net worth is, without disclosing the full decimal point, if you will. Using systems and tools like that can start to get generations down to understand, yeah, there's a lot here. I don't know what, maybe it's not 100% if generation one isn't willing to share. But that's something that's super personal to every single individual family that goes through the process. And we just have to build structure around how we can still educate if they don't want to.
Right.
And so we have to respect that. That might inhibit some of the ability to move the family forward, but it's definitely a part of it.
Yeah, you could absolutely do it without it. I mean, we've done many without having to share it.
Yeah.
How formal do you prefer the process to be, or do people prefer the process to be? I can imagine some people want to run kind of loose and not too structured, and other people, but I imagine the structure has a lot of value.
Yeah, it does. And it goes back to personal choice. We've got some families that come from, say, a certain industry that have just organizational structure is in their brain a certain way. So following a very particular path works really well for everybody downstream. And some that it's, hey, we understand we have to follow a guideline or a path, but we can do it a different way. Like execution can happen a different way. We've got to make sure we check the right boxes to make sure we're hitting all the important segments and points of the process along the way. Because if you skip something, it might come back in a future conversation that we should have covered that we didn't, that might have inhibited some of the growth that we're trying to get to.
I imagine people want to, some people might want to avoid or procrastinate because they don't want to open old wounds.
Sure.
They don't want to, let's say between the siblings, there's old wounds and they haven't quite healed yet. There's still rawness between, I don't know, sister-in-law, brother-in-law, mm-hmm. you know, little league, who knows? And you get into those deep conversations and I don't want to break, you know, I don't want it to hurt today's family. I don't want to hurt Christmas because
right.
I had a tough discussion with, you know, all my children, and now Christmas is already an adversary. Now it's become an adversarial thing when at right. least it was great before. Sure. And now right. it's like we've created friction.
Yeah.
You must have seen that. Oh, yeah. And people, I know you've seen people that are concerned about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that could be a tough dynamic. And it depends on, I guess, you know, typically you'll see that in operating businesses with next generations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We see that a lot. But if you're talking about just like, you know, getting the family together and doing some, you know, a family meeting and it's maybe, you know, a family foundation and there's charitable intent, I wouldn't see something like that because there's enough, you know, if you have to give out 5% a year, you know, you could choose, you
yeah.
know, if this person believes about in this, you know, entity over here and this one and that, you know, you could divvy that up.
Yeah.
So it really depends on the asset or yeah. what we're talking about.
And I also think it's important to delineate between the discussion in these situations between, you know, legacy and value system and the difference between that and actual trust planning. Meaning, because I think a lot of times what happens is as you go through this process and people are thinking, well, you know, mom and dad or, you know, parents are thinking about this is the way the estate will distribute, like the dollars. And while that's clearly important in structure from legal and tax and all those things, it's also more about like, what does it mean to be part of our family? And so you can have disagreements interpersonally, like I may not get along with a sibling or whatever it might be, but I can still talk through what it means to be part of our family. Going back to your earlier comments, talking about Alex's kids being driven and thoughtful and doing all those things and giving back. You can have those discussions even in the face of maybe disagreements about personal things to where you clearly don't want to Thanksgiving dinner or any holiday dinner be disrupted or impacted mm-hmm. by these discussions, but making sure you're framing it the right way to say, we're not talking about the dollar distributing down to you guys today. We're talking about what does it mean to be part of our family so you all understand what we expect, what we believe, and how we hope generationally those things are carried on.
Yeah. Well, we've really complicated our situation, I think, because we all live on the same property. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we got these 74 acres, Haneyville, in the middle of Loomis. And so the three families live out there. And my idea is, is everybody's going to live out there. I'll live out there for the rest of my life. I'll die out there. My kids will die out there. The right. grandkids will be out there someday if everybody doesn't, you know, can still get along. But, you know, I don't know that that's what my kids, like if I was just saying what I would want, I would think that'd be the coolest thing in the world.
Sure.
But what makes them really want to do that? I mean, they're the reason we bought it. They wanted to do it. They were really excited about it. We really like it now. But to have that be where you force that upon them for the rest of their life, it seems like kind of almost like, that's a question. Should you force that upon them for the rest of their life, or do you allow them to, I don't know, split up their property and sell it and, you know, whatever, move away from each other and,
right.
you know, basically divide the family that we've spent a lot of effort bringing together. Mm-hmm. And that's because then you get to their next generation, then you got cousins, and you know, it's tougher to get cousins to get along, let alone brother and sisters, I would imagine.
So, yeah.
Like, that's got to be an interesting twist. Have you ran into that before?
Yeah, and I would say that translates not just to, you know, physically living in the same place, but it's also owning assets on the balance sheet that we have to own them together because they're structured a certain way. So say I own a shopping center and I own it with my four siblings, and the only way that I can own it is through that entity, which I can't own by myself.
Right.
I have to own it with everybody else. So you've got to be able to work that through.
And just selling it and paying taxes and all that, it's like, that's you know, probably a bad decision. Best to just everybody split the income at some level.
Right. Yeah. And so, the dynamic that you're referencing with your situation, I think it just goes back to, what do you all believe? I know you and Stacey are very, very big believers in family and community, and you want people there. And it just goes back to just value system. Mm-hmm. How do you educate? You can't force necessarily. We've seen some families were like, well, you have to do this or else your proceeds from the distribution of the estate changes. Well, that creates a whole other dynamic, right? So it's just how much do you really want to press?
I'm lucky because my kids are both built that way.
Yes.
So that's, I'm really lucky, but they're also super competitive with one another. And so there's always, it's not always easy to, get through a barbecue, right?
I get it. So,
but it's all fun. We get out there, we're just competitive, We're all, we could be out there playing volleyball as, four on four volleyball, and it's like, hey, somebody thinks it was in, the other person thinks it was out.
It's blood
like,
shows
it's
up.
Not like, just your family. Everything our kids do is the World Series of whatever. It could be throwing an airplane, paper airplane.
Ping pong balls to each other.
It doesn't matter.
Olympic sports. So
same thing. We have the same issue.
I love it. Okay, so then talk to me about the, you mentioned the, and I have to imagine that the tax strategies involved, obviously, in the transition, as you as you want to get some of that wealth out of your name while you're alive, potentially, or when you die, there's you want to avoid as much tax as you can, so there's enough to go around. What are the kinds of things that go into that plan, and what's the good news, what's the bad news?
I'll start. And then I think the first part, and I've talked about this before, is having a good team, right? It's having advisors around you that can educate you. Clearly, this year is a great example of years where policy has changed, right? You had an extension of the TCJA, modified the estate tax code in particular, and changed it reasonably given where we thought direction was going. So making sure you have people on your team that can coach you through that, whether you're generation one or generation three.
Now, are you talking about the estate tax that you pay,
right?
You die, there's only so much that you can give to your kids without triggering tax.
Unified credit.
Right. So that's changed. Maybe tell me just how that, just for our audience, how did that stay the same, or what I know there was an expectation that it might change.
And there was a lot of discussion whether it would go up or go down. So coming into this year, you had roughly 12.7, I forget what the exact number was, $1 million of lifetime credit, unified credit, that you could use per person. So with the extension or update, I don't know what the right term is, update of TCJA, it's now for 2025 at 13.99 per person, and 2026 moving forward, it's 15 million with an inflation adjustment. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that if you got two kids two parents, they could pass along 30 million before it triggers an estate tax.
Correct. Yep.
And then on the estate tax, how is that estate tax, what's the rate? You pay in California, you pay federal, right?
No California, just federal.
No, yeah. Okay, no,
it's 40% California federal. 40%.
Yeah. 40?
40%.
Yeah. Anything in excess of the amount. So if, and again, it's a little different today with that inflation adjustment, but yeah, it's a 40%.
And let's talk about so the shopping center example.
Yes.
We got a shopping center that's worth, I don't know, maybe I got a bunch of real estate that's worth $50 million.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, I've exceeded my 30. Yeah. And so what am I going to do? Let's say I got one kid. What am I going to do? Because if I sell the thing while I'm alive, I'm going to pay capital gains on it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to pay, you know, I'm going to pay tax on that. If I pass it along, it's over the threshold. Mm-hmm. So they're going to have a taxable gain. There's not enough cash in my estate to, you know, it might force me to sell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a challenging thing to deal with, because you're right. If there's not enough liquidity, you know, when you go through that tax filing of, you know, final passing generationally down, it's what, 9 months, 7 to 9 months, something like that, to deal with the 706 and the different filings that have to happen. And if there's not liquidity, you got to find liquidity, because the tax bill is going to come.
Interesting. It might. So the a plan, I'm just thinking out loud on a plan. you guys come in and help drive these kind of this understanding, so that somebody might take, you know, their $50 million asset and maybe carve it up into smaller real estate assets through a 1031 exchange or something like that. And then you can liquidate some small amount, so you have enough cash to deal with the tax, but yet the properties, you're still able to pass along a bunch of real estate.
Yeah.
Yep. And there's other strategies, attorneys, and typically Jay alluded to a team, right? So the CPA, the attorney, ourselves will come in, we'll all cohesively work together. But, you know, a lot of attorneys are recommending like irrevocable trusts. So you can put the asset into that trust. It's out of your, and you use up some of your exemption while you're alive, but it's able to grow outside of your estate. So if you're expecting, you know, some high growth asset, typically you'll see estate planning attorneys recommend something like that, and that could potentially reduce it.
Tell me about the irrevocable trust. So you put your wealth, assets, let's call it, into an irrevocable, which means you can't take it out, right? It's irrevocable, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But you still have influence over that investment, or somebody, you hire an advisor to
there's a couple different ways to set it up. There's all sorts of different sorts of trusts. You know, the a common one we're seeing these days is the SLATs, spousal mm-hmm. lifetime access trusts. I don't know if you've heard of those.
Yeah, I have.
So there's all, that's an irrevocable trust essentially. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot like that, and so it depends on the trust, but there's a good attorney will be able to set
it up. A good attorney will give you your options.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, interesting. Yep. Okay, so you need an attorney, estate planning attorney.
You really want someone that's focused and comfortable with estate tax code. So estate planning attorney is super key. Someone that's comfortable with tax. So you'll find somebody that maybe has a master in taxation. We find it valuable when you have a law firm that has the individual estate planning side, as well as maybe a corporate planning side, because a lot of our clients are dealing with either operating entities or entities that own assets. So understanding corporate structure and how you build those, that's within, you know, legal and tax code that benefit you and generationally benefit down, as well as pair well with the personal estate plan.
I have to imagine the great attorney is going to keep things from being challenged afterwards too, right? So you need all the tax strategies, of course, but you also don't want somebody that you weren't expecting to come in and challenge, you know, the estate and maybe file a lawsuit against the state. You want something that's kind of like ironclad.
You really do. And it's not even that. It's also just that sniff test of am I raising a red flag to get audited? Am I going to go through something that's going to trigger, you know, litigation from a beneficiary or somebody outside of the state that thinks that they were, you know, should have been bequeathed something. And so it's also setting expectations, like realistic expectations and planning. Hey, we can accomplish this. There's lots of strategies that kind of skirt lines. We're not necessarily big fans of those, because you can still accomplish really successful planning without stepping over a line to where you might push the envelope to, mm-hmm. you know, red flag for audit or anything like that too. So,
okay. So you need a good attorney, mm-hmm. Estate planning attorney. What's the rest of the team look like?
Tax advice is huge. So
okay.
That's a huge component.
That's not the estate planning attorney. It's a different person.
Yeah. It's your CPA. Okay. You just want a high qualified CPA, and everyone on the team, advisory team, tax and legal, should have comfort discussing, modeling, having independent conversation about any of those topics. But as you get into the more granular aspects of all those, you just want a high quality team that you can all sit together and
you discuss. Guys are the advisory people. Yeah. So the advisory people are kind of looking at the big picture of like who you can bring into the team,
yep.
evaluating the team and making sure that the process,
right.
is good and is ongoing.
Yeah. And we'll typically run kind of quarterback, if you will, run strategy, not just on investment allocation or, you know, asset location, the type of account you'll use, but it's also about, hey, this idea around whether it's a SLAT or a tax planning strategy or a cash flow model based upon tax efficiency, we can model all those scenarios, run them past this discussion, and then bring in tax and legal and say, here's what we're talking about. What do you guys think? What do we get right? How do we optimize based upon their expertise? And then everyone collaborates together.
Yeah, it makes sense. Okay, yeah. So that team needs to get brought together. You never know when you're going to die or, you know, things could happen. Somebody could get sick.
Yeah.
And you don't want to make all your decisions sort of like when you're in a really stressful moment.
Right.
To me, it seems like making really good decisions should be thoughtful over time when you're of sound mind and body.
Right? Completely agree.
Yeah. So it's like, when do you do it? Do you do it before, you know, you've got something that, like, in a lot of people that I deal with, a lot of their wealth is maybe in their real estate and in their business.
Yeah.
And then you never know when you're going to sell your business or something like that.
Yeah. I think just the idea of planning, even if you're planned exit is 15 years down the road. Mm. And by exit, I mean selling the business. Maybe I'm 75 years old. I think I'm going to live till 90. You know, early planning always benefits you.
Okay.
The challenge that comes out is there's a lot of unknowns, right? To your point. And so thinking through in, you know, the right sound in mind, thinking through the idea of here's scenario A, B, and C, that will challenge you to make difficult decisions or at least have the discussion around difficult decisions to where you've already set the table now, to where I know I've got to deal with this at some point. Let's hammer it out and go. And that way you can make modifications. Planning is a living process. It's not like you sign and you can never modify it. It's like, look, irrevocable is different, you know, as far as taking it back. But from a planning standpoint, you can always go back and say, look, I thought this, I'm thinking this, whether it's a business exit, where it's part of my estate plan, whatever it might be. So having those early thoughtful discussions with the team that you have, and part of that team should be part of the family too, right? Mm-hmm. So we talked, starting this off, about legacy and stewardship, bringing in family members when it makes sense as early as possible so they're part of that dialogue. So they have buy-in, so they have understanding of values, what it means for them, generationally down from them. Everything is super important.
Yeah. So let me see if I can recite some of the learning points from today. So start early with the kids, right? Get the right, you know, get the, it was save.
Save, share, spend.
Save, spend, share, save, send, in that order. So that's important at the early ages. I think do a family mission statement. That gives you something as a North Star, something to kind of work toward. Mm-hmm. It's sometimes those are kind of aspirational, and we're going to do this for this reason.
Yep.
You mentioned values and maybe the parents in the case or the people with the wealth deciding what their values are and then how those might align with the deep deeper family values. Mm-hmm. Build the right team. Are there any other like lessons that I'm sort of forgetting here?
No, I think that's a great summary. I mean, the whole point of in our minds of legacy is bringing the collective family together to one, extend, you know, who you are as a family, what you believe in, giving back, which really impacts usually to the positive, to the greater community, right? Building on legacy, sharing, getting people together, doing things that are meaningful. Those are all building blocks for doing that.
Yeah. And one of the things that, you know, I know you and the Growth Factory team have talked about is not everybody has this financial literacy. You even brought that in with the way you're training your kids, but not everybody's got that. So for the people that maybe aren't as versed in that and sharing some of those, you're not financial people potentially, or they might not have the relationship or the time with their kids to drive through some of these basics. And also sometimes having a third party come in and bring it to you in a less threatening, authoritative way. Parents can be authoritative. So I think sometimes it is good to send your kid to finance, you know, financial school, if you will. And I know you've talked about some of that. Is there some of that that's available now to do, or is that something that you're building out?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of resources out there that folks have access to. We're big believers. There's no downside risk in having a higher level of financial literacy for anybody, right? It just helps you make better, more informed decisions in life choices, whether that's saving to pay for your own way through school, whether that's buying your first car, your first house, whether or not you use a credit card or take a loan. Any of those things are super important. So I think from a resource standpoint, it just depends on what's available to you. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the marketplace, I know that you've read a ton of books, Alec, in that space, and you use those with the kids in particular.
And we've got some junior achievement material that we've used for clients as well. And we've created our own, system or PowerPoint for depending on the age. And it's typically going to be the same topics that we're going to be talking about for that younger generation. They're not going to want to talk about specific stocks or ETFs or anything like that. It's more general concepts like compounding interest and starting early. I mean, the biggest asset for a child is time, right? So, you know, using that time wisely, I always say, you know, getting a good education and, you know, that's going to get you typically a better salary, right, or earn out, right? Mm-hmm. And then you take that money and you could look to invest it, right, and grow your wealth.
For sure. And the Growth Factory, our nonprofit arm, we do a lot with students, like high school students and college students, around building businesses, which is a component of it, but there's a little bit less of that financial literacy piece. Obviously, buy low, sell high, those kind of things kind of come up. You know, you got to drive revenue and that kind of stuff. But it's less about building wealth and that kind of thing. It's more like how to build a valuable company potentially, or a company that does what you want to do. I definitely see a huge difference.
Yeah.
And that what you're talking about, financial literacy, every human on the planet pretty much needs that.
Yes. Yeah,
whether you're going to build a business or not.
Yeah, completely agree.
Okay, so I'm going to use something Alex said to transition into the final, I guess, part of the conversation, and that you use the term compounding effect. So as we talk about the economy and investing, where do you invest, and you know, to get the compounding effect to kick in, maybe talk a little bit more about the compounding effect and that principle. I was lucky. My dad taught me that principle. I was able to buy real estate, and you know, I watched a lot of financial shows when I was little about, you know, put low money down, mm-hmm. and then watch the compounding effect that happens if you have a piece of real estate that that goes up in value at X percent per year, and if it's, you know, cash flowing, it can be a really good way to build wealth.
Right.
So I've always thought about that compounding effect. Less of it in a bank account, because that's kind of like safe compounding. It's almost like not keeping up with inflation.
Right.
So you need something that's going to compound at a rate above inflation.
Right.
And that inflation is probably the hottest topic that, you know, that's on. It doesn't matter what news channel you're watching. It's coming there. Up, the cost of living. So you got to keep up with the cost of living. So what are you thinking in terms of that today?
Yeah, I think when you look at the idea of compounding, I think I'm going to just throw a first concept out. The idea of patience, number one. Mm-hmm. We had this discussion yesterday that there's the idea of how you think about your balance sheet, assets on your balance sheet, and we teach a lot, doesn't matter how successful you are, when I think about allocating a dollar, what is the purpose of that dollar, right? When do I need it, and what am I going to use it for? So if I need that dollar tomorrow, compounding doesn't matter for that dollar, right? It really doesn't, because I'm going to need to spend it tomorrow. But if I need that dollar 10, 15, 20 years from now, then I can think about the concept of different sleeve allocations, right? I can go into longer duration assets like public equities, private markets like venture capital, things like that. So those types of assets inherently have the benefit of compounding, because I have more duration, more time that I can let those things go. When you add the idea of compounding, especially tax efficiency, then it just amplifies or multiplies the value of that length of time it can stay invested. There's still diligence on the investment. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? What's the outcome, the risk, units of risk versus return, all of those things. But the idea of making sure the dollar that's being invested pairs with what it's investing in, I think is a super, to me, it's fundamental, like a basic concept, but I think people sometimes miss that.
You know, what's interesting to me, and it's going to fall back to something we talked about at the beginning, is today's, I was going to say youth, but I think today's American really is more excited about experiences than maybe I remember being as a kid. They want to go travel. You want to get out of high school and take a year off and travel. Those things cost money.
Right,
they when you start thinking about the compounding effect, right, that experience might compound in some way. Just sure. Of course, get the, you know, an education can compound, a relationship can compound,
right.
But it's much more tangible to see it in the S&P 500,
right.
To kind of expect it to go up over time, and you can actually see the results.
Yeah.
It's a balance. And what you're talking about, we talk about this all the time, the qualitative versus the quantitative, mm-hmm. right? And sometimes you could be one or the other too much. And everybody inherently has their own. I would say I'm probably too quantitative, mm-hmm. and that's probably being a financial advisor and seeing what I see and knowing. You mentioned compounding interest. I mean, Einstein called it the eighth wonder of the world. Mm-hmm. So that's where my mind's at, and sometimes I have to fight that and say, look, I want to, you know, go do this with the family or go on this trip because they're only young once, and I want to experience that. I want them to experience that. And so I talk about that all the time with clients, and sometimes they could be too quantitative. And I had a client yesterday say, can I fly business class? And after looking at all of the numbers, they could fly business class for the rest of their life.
You should get your own jet.
Yeah, honestly. And the reason though that I told him that he created this wealth and has this wealth is because he's been quantitative the whole, mm-hmm. his whole life. And so how do you shift that and adjust that? And I think it's a balance. And I think sometimes not just coaching people on, hey, like this dollar is going to make more here. It's like, hey, go live your life and have a fun time, right?
Right.
So, you know, I've heard everybody from Ray Dalio to most people say have some kind of diversification. Once you build some wealth, make sure it's diversified if you want to protect it and grow mm-hmm. it over time.
Yep.
So what's sort of overvalued today? And I mean, everything's got they say that we're in a bubble. You know, the national debt is at $38 trillion. It looks like we're going to be printing more money unless we have you know, we can eliminate the deficit and, you know, through productivity gains from AI or something like that. Otherwise, it looks like, you know, everybody's appetite is to, you know, just continue. Everybody in the U.S. is, they just want to keep printing more money and finding a way to, like, restructure the debt.
Yeah.
So, which to me seems like more inflation over the long haul. So, where do you see that? And are we in a bubble today?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think the concept of whether or not we're in a bubble really applies to certain parts of, I would just say, capital markets globally. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of talk of, you know, S&P valuation. I'm not a market technician, nor am I a guy that necessarily looks at valuation of indexes. Because again, the S&P today as an index from a composition standpoint is quite different than the S&P 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Market cap weighted index, you have different companies that weigh more, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at the top 10 today, it's entirely different than 20 years ago. So the hard part is determining if I can use a historical valuation metric to value what the index looks like today. I'll still go back to if I'm investing capital that has a longer duration timeline to it, to public equity, and I don't need that dollar today and I can get it through a market cycle or two, bubble conversations maybe aren't as pertinent, right? Your comment about the debt and deficit, to me, the U.S. debt is probably systemically one of the most important things that needs to be addressed in this country that I don't think there's a lot of appetite to address.
Politically fashionable to talk about not spending more money, you know, cutting programs, stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. And it would be a difficult proposition to grow your way enough in GDP growth in the United States to pay down where we sit today. So it's a function of, unfortunately, revenue increase, spending reduction. How you do that, I'm not a guy in DC, mm-hmm. so I'm not going to comment on that. But that discussion should be had. And it's not a politically viable conversation, but it needs to happen. As an American citizen and taxpayer, I'd love to see that happen.
People want to get reelected, so that's not the popular talking point.
It's unfortunate. It really is. And that's a difficult thing, because what that then challenges is the thesis of investment viability and growth initiatives in the United States, right? And so whether you just fund it through, you know, printing money and more deficits and debt isn't functionally viable generations down. We talk about legacy, right? Yeah. And so we can't strap generations with, you know, our burden because we can't manage our own finances as a country.
Okay, I'll just ask you to make a prediction. Last question for both you guys. So that's interest. Like we know Trump's trying to drive down short-term rates, right? We know that's happening. He's going to, depending on who he gets into the Fed and, you know, how much they're going to want to cut to try to stimulate the economy.
Sure.
But what will that do to the 10-year, which is a lot of what the house prices are and stuff like that? That's market driven. Mm-hmm. And so that's now at, I don't know, four?
It was 4.11, I think.
It's at 4.11 today, and we're recording this on December 6th, 7th? What's the date? 5th?
5th.
Oh, geez, you're close. Gotta step ahead. So it'll probably be around there on the first of the year. So what will... A year from now, what will the 10-year be? Because there was a time when we cut the short term and the long term went up.
The
interest rates went up. So that has to do with people's belief in the U.S. economy.
Absolutely.
Right? So if they don't believe in the U.S. economy, they don't want to lend us money or whatever. So, you know, the rates go up.
Yeah.
So to me, that's a really good barometer of like, how strong the U.S. is going to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, are we going into some kind of debt spiral?
Right.
So where will the 10-year be, let's call it the end of next year, right? Okay. We're in 2025. Where will it be at the end of 2026?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it really is a meaningful question, because it is a driver of, I think, two things. Fed policy, what's the Fed going to do? And the Fed's going to change, right? You've got clearly shifts going on right now. And I think Powell's term is up Q2 of next year, something like that. And so with the probability of a rate cut next week on December 10th, that probability is much greater than it was a month ago when we had government shutdown and everything like that. And the probability of 3 to 4 rate cuts in calendar 26. So in theory, if you get 4 rate cuts at a quarter point, so 25 basis points, the front of the curve drops by a full percentage point, right? That doesn't mean the 10-year drops by a full percentage point. So my view is that the 10-year, call it just over 4, is in the low to mid 3s by the end of next year.
Low to mid 3s.
Yeah.
So give me an exact number, because I think we should bet a large beverage on
it. I like this.
I saw a bottle
over
here.
So you're low to mid, so are you talking 3.3, 3.4?
I would say 3.4.
3.4 with Alec?
Okay. I'm going to take the other side of this bet, okay. And I'm going to tell you why. If Trump puts in somebody to reduce rates, and I don't know if that's, I mean, Goldman Sachs came out and said last week that they expect 3% on the Fed funds rate next year, at the end of next year.
Okay.
So they're expecting a rate cut in December this month and 2 next year.
Mm-hmm.
If Trump puts in who he wants to put in and gets the interest rates down to where he wants to get them, I'm a little bit suspicious on what happens with Japan. I don't know if you've been following that.
I have.
Their debt
and
their interest rates. They're a big buyer of our of the U.S. Treasury.
Right.
So that could potentially have them selling the Treasury going into their bond, right? Which could potentially lower demand and increase the interest rate.
Right.
So I'm going to say 4.2.
4.2. Okay, I'll take. So you're at 3.4?
Yep.
4.2. I'm going to go 3.75. I'm going to pick somewhere in the middle.
Okay.
And because I think that there'll be, which will be good for help housing a little bit. You get things a little bit more affordable for, you know,
for lending,
mortgages and stuff. Yeah. So I'm hoping that, and I think that that's a priority of the administration, is to make things more affordable. And not that the administration can have that much control over the longer rates, but you know, I think they're going to find ways to manufacture that, and that ultimately AI and the investment into infrastructure and stuff like that will demonstrate a stronger America middle to end of next year. So sure, hoping yeah. that drives down the tenure a little bit.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I would agree.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on the show, guys.
Appreciate it. Thanks
for having me.
Yeah, it's a fun combo. I could have this instead of talking to you guys all the time. That's what I think about. So I appreciate it. I don't know if our audience likes it, but thank you guys for coming on the show.
Appreciate it. Thanks,
Mark.
Thank
you, Mark.
And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at Haney Biz, the Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you. We're never below you. Always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in the segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.